So I've heard you say that you're influenced by Expressionism, Fauvism, and Neo-Impressionism. And I know what Expressionism and Neo-Impressionism are to a degree, but I'm not very familiar with Fauvism. So maybe if you could start with that and tell us a little bit about each of those movements.
Yes. Fauvism is kind of similar to Impressionism in that it is based off of an image, kind of like how the Impressionists would base their paintings off of something. The Fauvists also did that, but they inserted more of their own emotions to it and kind of took it like a step further from the Impressionists, where they used even bolder colors, even slightly more skewed views of reality, bolder marks, brighter colors, and a lot of their emotions were at play when they were making their pieces. So similar to Impressionism in that it is their impression of it, but furthering on past Impressionism, where there's even more interpretation in their work.
Is there a difference between Impressionism and Neo-Impressionism?
I wish I paid more attention in my art history classes when I was in college, when I started going to art school. Any academic class that I had to take just felt so painful, where I was like, I'm at art school and I want to be creating all of the time.
No, in a lot of ways, it's like micro genres within music. One which I came up against recently was vaporwave. Butterfly would be considered vaporwave. Like, I would have difficulty telling you what vaporwave is as well, because I don't deliberately do it. It's just a particular sound that I'm attracted to. But if you look vaporwave up on Wikipedia, it actually says that it's a micro movement, which tells me that it was like maybe three artists who decided that what they were doing was important enough to give it its own name. Ultimately Butterfly is just a techno track, and I'm happy just to call it that. I try to avoid pretension, when it comes to my music, because I feel like that sometimes acts as a barrier between creativity and expression.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think when I was in college, I knew that I sort of viewed knowledge as almost like a surface level kind of thing, and creativity is more of a soul level thing. I think as I've gotten older, I definitely don't know that I think that anymore, where I think know as much as you can so that you can effectively break more rules. But yeah, when I was in school, I was kind of like, whatever, I just want to create from my heart.
Again, I can completely empathize with that too. When I started audio engineering, there were all these dudes who knew all about the latest pieces of equipment and knew all the makes and model numbers of things. And I would get very frustrated because I wasn't able to remember the names of particular pieces of equipment. But I remember reading an interview with a producer that I admire, and I can't actually remember who it was right now, but he said something really profound that just completely relaxed me in that regard. He said, "I don't care what it's called as long as it sounds good."
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. Neo-Impressionism is just, I think, a little bit more of a refinement of it.
Do you know when Impressionism sort of first hit the scene?
19th century.
Is Neo-Impressionism a 20th century movement then, like a revival?
Neo-Impressionism is a late 19th century movement, and Impressionism is an early 19th century movement.
Okay. Can you maybe give us an example of an Impressionist painter, a Neo-Impressionist painter, an Expressionist painter, and a Fauvism painter?
An Impressionist painter Claude Monet. Actually, the Art Institute has, I think, the biggest Claude Monet collection in the world. Before I started painting, but was just kind of an admirer of painting, Claude Monet was my favorite because I thought that what he was doing, I thought it was so poetic, where he, you know, like take the haystacks, for example, how he was like, I'm going to paint the same thing over and over again, but paint it at different times of day with different lights and different colors. I love Claude Monet. He's another one that I think is easy to diss on just because he's so popular and just because he was so influential. But that's an example of an impressionist.
So what about expressionism?
Paul Klee would be considered expressionism. Ernst Ludwig Kirchner, Wassily Kandinsky. Munch is, I think, technically considered expressionist too. Joan Mitchell is an example of an expressionist painter. And expressionism came about in the 20th century, and it was kind of like a complete, like, we're not concerned with the objective image at all. And we are interested in expressing ourselves using these mediums that are normally used to create something of likeness to the world. We're now going to use it to create something of likeness to what is going on inside of us, inside our hearts.
And I think it's very easy. So, okay, let me frame this by saying, you know, I've had conversations with people who are almost offended by expressionist paintings. You know, they say they don't understand modern art. That's an expression that you hear a lot from people. Mm-hmm. But I think that if you stand somebody, because look, I grew up in a small town in the west of Ireland. I wasn't exposed to a lot of expressionist art, but when I started getting exposed to it, and I don't know how that happened, you know, it was very easy for me to identify the stuff that was genuine because if it's a genuine expression of emotion, you can feel it. You can almost physically feel it. Mm-hmm. So what I say to people who have that attitude towards modern art is, I think you're looking at the wrong stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Or maybe you haven't found the artist who expresses the sort of things that you're feeling.
Do you know Cy Twombly?
I do, and I only know him because you introduced me to him.
Cy Twombly is one of my favorites. I mean, I think also the thing with a lot of these artistic movements is that they overlap each other so much.
So Fauvism, is it, who from Fauvism springs to mind?
Henri Matisse.
Okay, that's interesting because I know Matisse, but I never heard him described as being a member of the Fauvism movement.
I think because of when he was alive, he wouldn't quite be considered an impressionist. Henri Matisse, though, is probably one of my all-time favorite, if not favorite, artists.
Nice. So your major wasn't actually in painting, though. It was in creative writing. So I wanted to ask you, before you ended up at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, you had given a good college try to another institution.
Yeah, so my freshman year of college, I went to Truman State University. Famous people who have been to Truman State University. I was actually just thinking about this last night. Pam from The Office went to Truman State University.
That's her actual name in real life.
And her real life name is Pam, middle name from, last name, The Office. It was a great school. It was a public college, so that meant it was less expensive than other colleges of its rank, but it was a pretty prestigious little school. It was just not the school for me. I was a young 18-year-old in some ways when I went off to school. I literally was a young 18-year-old because I had just turned 18 before my freshman year of college. But I was also, I think, kind of emotionally young at the age of 18. I was very Christian at the time as well. And so I had this idea of what college would be like. And when I got there, I was like, people are drinking, there are parties. I was a little bit like, it was a little bit too much of an eye-opening experience for me at the time, I think, as well as just being in the middle of nowhere in Missouri. By the time I was in college, I had such a hard go of high school. All throughout high school, I was like, oh, this is tough. I don't feel as though I fit in at all. But when I get to college, so says the media, the depictions of college. You know, I had two older brothers who went to college and loved it. I was like, when I get to college, I'm gonna find my people, and I'm gonna finally feel like I fit. And I got there, and that was not the case at all. I felt more alone than I did when I was in high school. I felt like I was, because of the way that I was raised, I felt like I was seeing these huge things, these awful, sinful things for the first time. And I just felt so like I was looking for people who could understand me. And I just didn't find it. Retrospectively, if me now, as a 27-year-old, could relive my 18-year-old year, I think I would be better at being 18 now than I was when I was actually 18. Because if I were to just transplant back to that year, I would have gone to all of the parties. I would have done all of the fun things. But I just didn't then, because I didn't know how.
Would you be able to have as much fun as you think you would, considering the people that you were with? You know, obviously when we party together, it's a lot of fun, but there's some years between us, but we're not bringing any immaturity to the party. I think 27-year-old Megan's brain in 18-year-old Megan's body would be just as pissed off with all the other 18-year-olds at the party.
I mean, yeah, and that's not to say I don't have any wish to go back to my freshman year of college at all. I more so mean that if I could have given my 18-year-old self, like if I could bless my past self with just some perspective, I think as an 18-year-old with an 18-year-old brain, but with more perspective on the world, I would have really enjoyed my state school experience.
What was it that you were going to study there?
I was studying creative writing.
Okay, so when you moved to SAIC to their creative writing program, was the curriculum more suited to your particular creative mind, or was it the environment that was better suited to you?
I think both. I think both very much. The creative writing program at Truman was pretty new. With that being said, I don't want to altogether completely just throw out my experience there, because I did have two very particular professors while I was at Truman who helped my growth as a writer. Yeah, the environment there just wasn't suited for me. When I went to SAIC, it was both the curriculum. Being a part of an art school was so exciting for me, and it was kind of like this part of me that I didn't know that I needed to nurture until I got there. And then also the environment of, being in the middle of the city, being around more like-minded people. I think it was both. And the curriculum at SAIC, so SAIC is an art school, but it's technically a liberal arts school as well, in that you have to take like a kind of a wide variety of courses, academic courses, alongside your studio courses, as they would call them. So they would consider a creative writing course was considered a studio course in the same way that a painting course would be considered a studio course. So I had a certain number of like just creative writing courses that I had to take, but I could fulfill the rest of my studio credits with either writing courses or visual arts courses. And I think that setup of the curriculum got me into visual art making in the first place. But that was so well suited for me because when I first started going there, I was taking creative writing classes, but I was also taking drawing classes and painting classes and performance classes that were all brand new to me and that I fell in love with that I wouldn't have done at a different university.
So the creative writing part of that course, was it focused on long form stuff? You know, you're obviously focused on poetry now, and which I can't read without crying.
That's a great advertisement for it.
Megan Escoff's poems. Yeah, read them. were you focused on longer form stuff, or is poetry something that you've come to subsequently? And I suppose if you could maybe prime us before you answer with who were the people that got you into writing in the first place?
The writers, I mean, if you go way back, J.K. Rowling, the Harry Potter series as a kid, I read those books maybe 10 times growing up. When I first read Harry Potter when I was 8 years old, and I remember reading the first book and being like, I love reading so much. And then that very quickly turned into, I love writing so much. I won a little writerly award when I was 9 years old in my class. And I remember I was like, this is my calling. This is it. In high school, man, I mean, I've read so many books. I mean, I've always been such an avid reader. I'm trying to think of what I enjoyed. I really liked in high school the author Jonathan Safran Foer. Are you familiar with
No,
him?
No, I don't think I've heard of him before.
He wrote Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, that was probably my favorite book all throughout high school. That one kind of blew my brain because that was like a interdisciplinary book. It had, you know, it had pictures in it and it had different sections in it. And it was very like the writing was so earnest and it was talking about the like people's very earnest feelings and philosophies and like talking about life and death and what it all means. And I was like, yes.
The creative writing class at SAIC was centered on long form stuff, was it?
No, the curriculum was pretty open. There were, you know, poetry classes, creative nonfiction classes, fiction classes. So I kind of dabbled around. I took some fiction writing classes. I took some creative nonfiction writing classes. It wasn't actually until my second to last semester at SAIC that I started getting into poetry writing.
Had you been into poetry previous to that, just as a reader?
Not really, actually. It kind of came upon me. My curriculum, my senior year of college, I took a creative writing thesis course that was kind of like the capstone in order to graduate. And my professor for that course, Layla Wilson, is an incredible poet. And she read the work that I was coming into the course with and was able to give me really pointed, really excellent advice on how to kind of trim the fat of what I was writing. Because I wasn't really, when I was going into that course, I wasn't really writing fiction or nonfiction or poetry. It was kind of more confessional.
That makes sense. I read the essay that you read for your college application. It's really beautifully written, very confessional, but also this is a through line in all your work, is it's just extraordinarily honest and open.
Sincerity is what it's all about.
Yeah.
But yeah, she was kind of able to see what I was doing, where I was kind of like blending, you know, I was kind of doing a lot of genre blending And she was kind of able to see what I was doing and was like, if you kind of like trim a lot of this fat, you have like some really outstanding poems. And it was through kind of her guidance through that course that I started writing poetry.
Subsequently, have you any poets that you draw influence from or admire at least?
My favorite poet right now, contemporary poet, is Heather Crystal. And she was one who was actually pointed out to me in that course. I love Heather Crystal. I'm a pretty big fan. I like Frank O'Hara. I like Mary Oliver. Anne Sexton is a good one.
Do you have any ambition to get back to longer form writing, or is poetry where it's at for you at the moment?
I think my writing process is such that longer form could come in very easily. I'm kind of open for the ride of whatever comes. Right now I'm working in the poetic form because I think you can make things really snappy in poetry.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of like my writing process is like throughout the week, I have a notebook and I'll just, you know, kind of write thoughts as they come to me in my notebook, or I'll type thoughts as they come to me in my computer. And then in a given week, I'm trying to complete a poem each week. So in a given week, I'll kind of look at all of this just kind of long form writing that I'm doing, and I'll try and literally sculpt it into a poem, which takes hours and hours and hours, and is it hurts.
But it's such a useful exercise, though. And there are a couple of people that I draw influence from in regard to that particular process. Bob Dylan being one. You know, he would sit down at his typewriter and just bang out page after page after page, and then sift through it for the things that would ultimately end up being his songs. I always admire writers who have an economy of words, you know, who can conjure up really vivid imagery in as few words as possible.
Yes. I mean, I think that's what the best poets do. in my opinion, they're able to do that so succinctly.
Yeah. I also think, though, the best long form writers are the ones who can do that, too. You know well that I've fallen off the reading wagon over the last few years in favor of podcasts. But the writers that I was always most drawn to were people who could get to the point in the least amount of words possible. It's a fine line that I walk in my own work, trying to make something beautiful, but also trying to be economical with language. I think the first writer that I ever read who really struck me as doing that was Evelyn Waugh. His novel Bride's Head Revisited is a short enough novel. I think it's like 270 pages, but it's so extraordinarily vivid that actually the television adaptation is 11 1-hour episodes, and they still don't cover everything that's covered in the book. You know, I've never quite understood the appeal of fantasy novelists, you know, like George or Martin, I think is his name, the guy who writes the Game of Thrones novels. Like, I really enjoyed the television show, but I'm not going to sit down and read 8 novels that are 800 pages each, you know.
I totally understand the appeal of that, just because I like reading is such a comfort to me. Like, reading books is just like a hug. And so I totally understand the feeling of, like, I mean, I read the Harry Potter series 10 times as a kid. So I haven't read Game of Thrones, but I like to read things that are going to at least a little bit influence my writing. And I'm not writing fantasy, so I don't read fantasy. But I totally understand the appeal of being like, oh yes, I'm gonna like get into this world. And it's not going to end for another 1,000 pages.
I wonder what the disconnect is there for me. My favorite writer is I have two who are currently battling for first place, Sebastian Barry and mm-hmm. Colin McCann, but they're both Irish, great geniuses for Ireland. But mm-hmm. They both have this beautiful economy of words, again, mm-hmm. that just, maybe it's an Irish thing. Because Ireland has a great history of
Ireland has so many good writers.
Yeah.
Ireland has so many good writers.
The English language was forced on us. It was illegal to speak our own language. So we kind of took the language that was forced upon us and made it more beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I think that's why we have so many great writers. That's definitely the school that I sort of draw from.
Mm-hmm. I was really inspired in college by Samuel Beckett. He took literature should make sense. Words in a sentence should make sense. That's kind of the deal that writers have. And Samuel Beckett was like, well, if painters can paint abstractly, then writers should be able to write abstractly. And he used language in an abstract way that I just admired and loved and didn't always understand, but like loved the concept of what he was doing so much.
One of the things that you've said is that you try to draw inspiration from the divine in every day. Can you define the divine for us? That's a Seinfeldian line, if ever. Define the divine.
Yeah, I know. If George was doing this interview, he'd be like, define the divine. The first thing that comes to mind from that question, defining the divine, it comes from being present in the moment that you're living in and noticing how beautiful otherwise very commonplace things are. So like I write a lot about sunlight and like the different, for example, like the different shapes that sunlight makes when it comes through a window or the different shadows that it makes. Like I draw so much inspiration from nature, and I think that the divine is present everywhere in nature. So like the divine could be defined as beauty. Although like my paintings, my drawings are very influenced by extraordinarily beautiful landscapes. I think living in Chicago, even there's so much to notice in just trees and in yards and the lake and the lighting in a given day. Like just the fact that no 2 days have the same exact lighting and that the clouds are always different. And
I completely understand what you mean, because as you know, I walk the same hill many times a week. There isn't a single day when I'm up there that I'm not inspired to take a photograph of something that I might have actually taken a photograph of hundreds mm-hmm. of times, at this point, hundreds of times before.
Mm-hmm.
Because the slightest shift in the light can bring out things that you've never seen before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm so influenced by light, which I think goes back to some of my favorite art movements. You know, like the Impressionists, for example, were obsessed with light. And I think there's something that is so poetic in how the same object can look different in different lighting. I'm really influenced by Virginia Woolf. She's one of my favorite writers, and one of my favorite books ever is Mrs. Dalloway, which is a book that takes place in one day. And in the scope of that one day, the themes of what it means to be alive are explored in very commonplace activities. Mrs. Dalloway like questions what it means to be alive just through walking down the street and noticing all of the life around her, as well as memory and the role that memory plays in our life and the experiences that we've lived. Another great author who I draw a lot of inspiration from, who is also an Irish author, is Claire Louise Bennett. Her book Pond, which is also kind of just like the philosophical in the day-to-day.
It's interesting that you bring up memory, because that relates to another question that I had written down here. Drawing inspiration from memory versus photograph. I know that you use both things to prompt your art. Can you talk a little bit about the pros and cons of each?
Drawing from photograph is helpful in terms of rendering something more closely to reality, but memory is sort of where the fauvist tendency in me comes out, where, you know, looking at a photograph will give me a roadmap for how to draw something, but the memory is where I get the feelings that I'm drawn to and inspired by.
Yeah, and that's definitely evident in your work, especially the work that is based on places that I've been. You know, it might not mm-hmm. necessarily be 100% correct in regard to how it looks in a photograph, but it's definitely very evocative of the feeling that you get when you look at the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I wanted to ask you about was the evolution of your color palette in regard to this, in regard to memory, you know, versus photograph as a means to prompt your work. On your website, you've got your current work, and then back through a number of years, there's a very noticeable evolution of your color palette. How would you connect that evolution to memory or awareness? Or am I looking too deeply into these things? Or is it just like, you know, any other sort of art practice in that you evolve naturally?
When I started out all of the work that's on my website back in 2017, I started it, I was really inspired right after a trip to Colorado. There was something in, I think, in my early work that was incredibly urgent. And I don't want to say uninformed, because that's not right. But I think like part of the natural evolution from, like, if you look, and I think you can see the contrast the most blatantly if you look at my 2017 landscapes versus my most recent landscapes, you can kind of see the contrast very clearly. We're like, when I was making my work in 2017, I did have a foundation of knowledge from school on how to render pieces from looking at something and then drawing what you see. But I was still honing in on the skill of rendering from what I see. And so I allowed for a lot of space for abstraction to be present in what it was that I was making. And I think just through the years, you know, practicing drawing from what I see for hours and hours and hours, there's more precision and the colors are more accurate, I think, to real life. They're still exaggerated, but they're more honed in. And in the work I was making in 2017, I sort of like, I had a very set color palette that I was using for each of the different pieces, where I think my work now, I am kind of looking more closely at the subtleties of the light and the subtleties of how does this piece specifically make me feel. I think my earlier work was more heavily relying on how does this make me feel? Like it was more heavily relying on kind of that expressionist feeling. And my work now is relies more on just maybe a deeper knowledge of how to create visual work.
With a view towards what, as opposed to expressing your emotions?
I think with a view towards, I don't want to say getting it right, but But I am looking more towards accuracy.
Yeah, it's something that's come up time and time again on this podcast, both in the audio essays that I do about my own stuff and the conversations that I have with the artists. Everybody seems to be striving for accuracy and authenticity. It's wonderful that that's yet again come up, you know. What's the best music to listen to when you're drawing?
It's like a very wide range, but it's very specific to what it is that I want to listen to, or like what it is that I'm feeling out.
Is there anything, okay, so let's say, you know, one of the things that most artists face is committing to a work and reaching a point where they feel like it's not finished, but they can't go any further. So the choice is to either put it aside or to push through. Is there any music that, you know, you would put on to maybe encourage you to push through something?
I wish I had maybe like a more specific answer for this. I love music so much. I think when I make a piece, I almost always, not always, I'd say maybe 98% of the time when I start it, I see it through to the end. I just enjoy listening to music so much, and I enjoy feeling so much, and that's why I like music, is because it makes me feel so much. So I don't know what the best music to listen to for me when I'm drawing. It's just kind of whatever I'm listening to at the time that has my ear.
Does music influence what you might draw? Is it something that just sort of allows you to get into the flow state?
I think both. I think more recently it's something that allows me to get into the flow state, or kind of like allows me to break kind of the barrier between like rational mind and emotional mind, and it kind of lets me get into more emotional mind. Like, you know, back to the differences in my work. When I was making work in 2017, for example, like music was heavily influencing my work, not necessarily in what it was that I was making, but like how I was making it. You know, like I would listen to music and feel the music, and then that was like going straight into my pieces, all of that emotion. Now when I listen to music, it's because I like to feel feelings, and I enjoy going down that road with myself, going on that trip with myself of listening to music and feeling things. But yeah, it does allow me to get into a flow state and to kind of like, I mean, something that I love about drawing over writing, for example, is that when I draw, I can listen to anything that I want. And I can take in the emotions of the music and just let it come out in what it is that I'm drawing. When I'm writing, I have to listen to like classical music or music without words.
Sure.
Because words distract me.
Yeah. Starting with you and then continuing with everybody that I've spoken to on this podcast, I've fallen back in love with listening to music and not feeling threatened by it, because for so long in my 20s, I was almost threatened by the music that other people were making. But recently, I've fallen back in love with listening to music by other people. And it's gotten to the point now where there have been times where I've been working on my own music and wishing that I could listen to other music at the same time, which is just absolutely fucking impossible. Or today, when I was writing the Spooky Action podcast, there was a particular artist that I wanted to listen to, but I was, again, frustrated by the fact that I knew that I would be distracted by the words. Even more weirdly, though, is it's this Italian artist that Debbie turned me on to. So even though I wasn't going to be able to understand the words that he was singing, they were still going to be so beautiful that they would distract me from the words that I was writing. It's such a strange thing. I know from what you've said and what you've written that music is a huge influence on you, and to the point that you've said that you feel that it's almost the most expressive form of art.
I think there is nothing like good music to just put you in the center of an emotion and of a feeling and of like an experience.
Do you have any thoughts as to why that might be?
I think I'm able to say music does that better for me than any other art. And I don't feel like any reservations in saying that, even though I'm a poet and a visual artist. I don't know. I think it's just the magic of music. I feel like you might be able to know.
No, I mean, I haven't, like, you know, it's something that the Milk Harbor Process podcast that I've been doing both solo and like this is sort of my attempt to try and quantify the magic of music. There are times where I feel like I've captured it, and then today when I'm writing about a piece of music, the construction of which was a very mechanical process, once I actually got down and started to write about how it all came together, it just was like magic again.
Something that I was just thinking too, though, like, we live in a time where any piece of art that you want to look at, you can look at immediately, and where any piece of music that you want to listen to, you can listen to immediately. I mean, it makes me kind of wonder if I was, you know, my age, but, you know, 50 years ago, how I would answer the question of what I find to be the most magical art form. Because right now I do think it's music. And that's also because, like, at any moment of the day, I can put on a song and feel into it. That's kind of another example of, like, the divine in every day, is that we're living in a time when we can listen to music anytime, anywhere. And I'm so grateful to live in a time that we have that. But, you know, like, listening to a really beautiful song and seeing a really beautiful piece of art in person, I mean, I do think that those are both equally magical experiences. But in terms of just like my everyday living, music is the art form that touches me the most.
Sorry.
I just spilled beer again because that's the type of person I am. I only spill beer when I'm sober. Like, I was thinking about this at the beginning. I used to have this thing where, like, the first drink that I would get at the bar, I would always spill a little bit of it. And I was like, gah, I'm not even drunk.
It's for your homies. So there's a couple more things that I wanted to ask you about. One thing that I've heard you say previously is that art practice is like a marriage. I wonder if you could expand on that, because I know your parents have a very successful marriage. And I know that marriage takes work and art, obviously. I know there are some days where it's a drag and some days where it's a pleasure.
This might be tangential at first, but one of my favorite professors in college, something that he told the class once was, let's say that a gallery approaches you and says, I want 10 paintings from you. You should make 50 paintings. And maybe 10 of them will be good enough to give to this gallery. That kind of always really stuck with me, because there's sometimes, I think, this misconception that an artist is just this inspired being, that you always are feeling the inspiration. And I just think that could be such a damaging misconception, because artists are, you know, like, we're just people with lives. And then we do have this passion. And I view, like, art making, it's something that I have to do. Like, it's almost never really been a choice for me. Like, even when I was young, it was like, I have to write and I have to draw. That doesn't necessarily mean that I always want to, or that my art practice is always going to be feeling good or feeling great. It's something that you have to work through even when you're not feeling good about it. And even when you're not liking what you're producing, it's kind of like you have this commitment with yourself as an artist where you're like, this is something that I know that I have to do. And so on days when I don't feel like it, I'm still going to show up for it. And I think, like, with anything that you're committed to, when you show up for it, even when you don't feel like it, that is sometimes when your most powerful work comes out. And I think it shows a great strength of character to be committed to something so strongly that you know that for the rest of your life you're going to be committed to it. And life is so unexpected and so much can happen, but to know that no matter what, you're always going to be showing up for your art practice. That's more of like a comment on commitment and the commitment that I feel towards my art practice, where it's like, I'm going to stick with it through the highs and through the lows, through the times when I don't feel good about what I'm doing and through the times where I feel great about what I'm doing. And it's cyclical. And I think that through periods of time in my life where I felt not great about my art practice, continuing to show up for it is what gets me out of the hump of not feeling good about it. As long as you're doing what it is that you know that you should be doing, the wheel is going to keep turning and the lows will become highs. And, you know, and naturally the highs aren't going to stay high forever and they're going to turn into lows. But as long as you just keep on going and going with it, that is how you're going to create a body of work.
That leads nicely into the last thing that I wanted to ask you about, which was, can you talk about courage and risk in your practice?
Courage is something that I am consciously thinking about almost every single day that I'm creating work. It's kind of natural for me to feel sort of like timid in the things that I do. And then there's always a voice in my mind that's like, just because you are feeling nervous about this, that almost means that you have to do what you feel like is the most courageous thing. I think that kind of comes from like a certain timidness or a certain shyness that I have with myself. I get nervous to really put myself out there in my own work, but that nervousness kind of is what then inspires me to just be like, no, just do it. Just make the mark that you feel is too scary to make. Write the sentence that you feel is too scary to write. Do it, you know, despite your fear of doing it. And it, you know, I think that's where a lot of magic comes from.
That's all that I had. Was there anything that you wanted to cover that I didn't ask you?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Do you want to tell the listeners where they can get your stuff?
Yeah, you can look at my website, which is meganeskoff.com, or check out my Instagram, which is MAE_SKOFF.
Okay, that's it.
Okay.